You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the Pope's tour of the US is in full swing and he's wasted no time in letting his political colours show. Unsurprisingly, a few on Capitol Hill aren't so impressed. Also ahead, the Russian president says he wants to join forces with the US in Syria, or he'll go it alone. How might Vladimir Putin's ultimatum be digested in Washington? Meanwhile, Angela Merkel says a solution to Europe's refugee crisis isn't possible without cooperation from Russia and the US. But how likely is that? Plus, the Greek government minister who lasted a whole 9 hours in the job. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one all to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, author and broadcaster for Politico.eu, and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and former diplomatic editor for Sky News. Welcome to you both. When the Pope touched down in the US this week, the country's media entered a spin as they rushed to cover every moment of his six-day tour. In Washington, D.C., however, many held their breath as they waited to assess just how political the tone of his dialogue might be. The pontiff's declaration of support for climate science angered a few on America's right some months ago, enough to prompt one Arizona congressman to boycott the Pope's visit. So just what is it about the Pope getting political that seems to upset people? Michael Goldfarb, the Pope undoubtedly is a political Pope. I mean, all Popes are political in some ways, of course, but...
It's that they don't like his politics. That's all it is. Look, you know, 30 years ago when Ronald Reagan was president and John Paul II was in the Vatican, believe me, all of these right-wing people, including the antecedent of whoever decided to boycott the Holy Father, they were all enthralled with the political Pope. When Pope John Paul II went to Central America in the middle of the 1980s, at the height of what was called liberation theology, and publicly excoriated his church leadership for backing the peasants who were rising up against these appalling fascists who were ruling over them in places like El Salvador, they were very happy that the Pope was political. And now here we are in Washington, you have a different Pope, and they don't like his politics. So I think we have to expect that when a Pope goes to Washington, D.C., and goes to the White House, and is using his own particular, is it a pulpit in the Catholic Church? I don't know, bully pulpit. Now, I mean, speaking ex cathedra, I think, is what we really need to say. Then you have to expect that he's going to say things. And let's face it, I mean, is climate change political? I don't know. Is talking about the global inequality of wealth and the maldistribution of wealth political?
Yes.
It is. Says Jim.
They both are.
Although, I mean, it's a separate discussion which perhaps won't go on to now, but I mean, there is perhaps an argument that climate change has got too political in the sense that it has made, you know, the left and the right have become polarised on it. But yes, on your second point, maybe, you know, it is political. Tim Marshall, okay, so as a political Pope, he's got something to say, but it's also, it's very difficult, or it's a lot harder to try and criticise a Pope who has positions rather than any old elected politician.
Immensely harder, because you can't say he's right-wing or left-wing because he is the Pope. But every Pope is political. Every single thing, almost, that comes out of their mouth in a speech is political. Everything they do almost is political. I mean, he showed up in a Fiat 500. That was political. That showed not only is he a man of great humility, but it also showed that he doesn't like all the nasty emissions that these big, huge jeeps or whatever pump out. Now, on climate change, given that 50% of the Republican Party politicians actually deny that it exists, to say on his bully pulpit all about it is deeply political. There has been a very small amount of pushback, which amused me. Yes, if you're going to talk about climate change, you need to talk about population control as well. And he's not going to do that.
No.
Michael, do you think that actually having the Pope talking about, let's say, climate change, does that help to push the debate on in the US?
Well, just speaking in political terms, look, the debate in the U.S. doesn't exist. I mean, if you say one thing and you disagree with it, then there's no more conversation, which is why there's such terrifying political gridlock. Terrifying because it's also exceptionally angry. We've had moments of gridlock, plenty of them in the last 30 or 40 years, but this is unprecedented in my lifetime. The only time it was close to this was just before the Civil War. So it is different. And I think the other thing that the Pope's presence has done, and this is probably a positive thing from the standpoint of the Catholic community, is you have no idea how deadly the pedophile scandal inside the church was to the Catholic Church as an institution. And the Catholic Church is a very political institution in America. The Catholic Church has delivered voters, primarily the Democratic Party, going back to the New Deal, going back to before the New Deal, when Al Smith was nominated to be president as a Democrat and was the first Roman Catholic to be nominated by a major party. You know, his statements and his kind of statements of remorse have also had a political impact in America, because it's meant that many Catholics who were no longer listening to their hierarchy are now paying attention.
Yeah, he has got our attention. He's got the wow factor. I looked at the figures before we came on. About 55 million Americans are Catholics, which is about 22% of the population. But it is the biggest single block, because the Protestant church is so split. So, you know, he is addressing a huge block. And within those 55 million, apparently 20 million of those are Catholics. There are 15 million, Latinos. There are 15 million Latino Protestants, but there's 20 million Latino Catholics. He's got their ear. He's got the ear of the entire Catholic population. Michael's right that they tended to lean towards the Democrats, but over the past couple of elections, again, I'm just looking this up this afternoon, it's pretty split evenly. But, you know, the bottom line is, a deeply political man and religious comes to the great superpower and says things. I agree with you about climate change, Michael. You either do or you don't. You know, there is no debate. But the things that he talks about, the faithful, there is a significant amount of them that actually listen and think, I will do what he says.
And this has been a very good visit for Barack Obama to host, because this is a Pope who is essentially, certainly when he's talking on these issues, is espousing views that President Obama is fully signed up to.
Exactly. And he rolled out the red carpet at the White House, took full advantage of the optics that go with a South Lawn event. And quite a few of my family live in Philadelphia, where he is, I think, today, and the city's in lockdown. I mean, it's up there with John Paul II and John the 23rd, who, when I was a kid, visited New York. When the Pope is popular with the American faithful, it becomes, in and of itself, such a popular event that it also becomes a political event.
Steve, briefly, I have some news for you, which I gained from CNN last night. They tweeted this. They tweeted, His Holiness the Pope will not be having any events tonight because it's in respect of Yom Kippur, the Jewish holy day, full stop, and then it said, the Pope is not Jewish. What a wonderful... Thanks, CNN.
Well, I'm glad that CNN pointed that out. Michael, of course, this is not the only visit to Washington this week of an unelected leader representing hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. Xi Jinping is also in town. Do you think, you know, when you compare the two visits... You know, the Pope's visit is obviously the one that gets the headlines. It's the ones that you know, creates the best pictures. But perhaps Xi Jinping's visit is more important long-term politically for the US.
Well, it's probably more important long-term economically, certainly. It's interesting. George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer, went to Xi But she is going to the US. Goes to show.
She had no time to see him. He had time to meet Rupert Murdoch last week, apparently, but hasn't had time to meet George Osborne.
Oh, well, I will say no more. It is, although, I mean, the politics around this, again, get into right-wing talk radio memes. I mean, China is still seen as the place that took away many an American worker's job and is seen actually, it's all kind of inscrutable, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean, it's just very, very difficult for people to understand what's under discussion. You will have your defense people writing about these new islands that China is building in the South China Sea and what they're for. They'll be talking about, you know, the business community will be discussing about the slowdown. They're only growing at 7% a year. The slowdown and whether the stock market in China is a bubble. They may even discuss climate change. Since China suffers.
Well, since it is something
the Chinese suffer in ways that we can't, unless you've actually been in China, you can't imagine what air pollution is till you've been there.
It's like living in a permanent fog that irritates your throat. There was three things that struck me about the Xi visit, all of them very, very political, and two of them were symbolic but political. One is that the Chinese Navy slipped into the Bering Straits, which is very close to the United States, and that was a big signal. You want to put your ships and submarines and aircraft carriers off our coast every day in the South China Sea. Well, we're going to put ours. Okay, we haven't got any aircraft carriers. Well, they got one, but it doesn't work. You know, that was a signal of the future. You're not the only global naval power. Foreign Policy put a headline out saying the US is no longer the only global naval power. I disagree. That was 20 years too early, but it was a big signal. The other signal was Obama, for the first time since 1964, American president is not staying at the Waldorf. Why isn't he staying at the Waldorf? Because the Waldorf is owned by the Chinese. And who might put listening bugs in? The Chinese. So again, he's not really worried about that. It was just a signal because of the espionage side of things, which leads me to the last bit, which is one of the most important treaties that's going to be signed this year or next year, cyber warfare. They are going to sign a treaty that they both agree that outside of war, they will not attack each other's infrastructure, water, telephone networks. It's the first cyber treaty. And I think it's actually quite a meaningful event.
And interesting as well that they are willing to sign that, yeah, rather than, you know, as has been going on for the past few years, both of them engaging in different ways. Mm. Michael Goldfarb, before we move on to our next topic, this is sort of a good, this time of the year is always a good moment for international diplomacy because, you know, with the UN General Assembly, you have so many world leaders all in the same place at the same time, even if, frankly, nothing happens at the UN General Assembly, and frankly, nothing ever really does. The fact that they are all there and having all these side meetings, we've just heard today that it seems as if President Obama and Vladimir Putin are going to meet. Whether they have anything, you know, useful to actually meet about is another question.
We'll probably come on to it, but they actually have plenty useful to talk about. The question is whether they're going to
agree on.
But just to say, Peter W. Singer, who's one of the most authoritative think tank defense analysts in America and in the world, tweeted today, there's an Uber for helicopters that's been started just for this week while the General Assembly is on that will get people from the East River to the Hudson River, from the east side of Manhattan to the west side of Manhattan, to avoid the gridlock, which happens for those days of the UN General Assembly.
Crosstown traffic. A whole new meaning.
It's a drag, man.
Genius. There we are. Okay, we just mentioned Vladimir Putin, and it's perhaps fair to say the Russian president has been having trouble making friends lately, ever since Vladimir Putin stormed his way into eastern Ukraine with less than subtle enthusiasm. Diplomatic tensions with just about everyone have affected Russia's ability to function, particularly its economy. But as Syria's war continues to spiral, Russia says it's ready to join forces with the US to take on ISIS. And if the US doesn't agree, they'll go it alone. Tim Marshall, Russia has seems to have changed tack somewhat, at least publicly, on Syria in the past week or so, has it not?
No, it has surfaced what it was been trying to do for some considerable time. I keep hearing, and I've been hearing this for years, that Putin is a good tactician but a terrible strategist. I don't agree. I think he's a good tactician and a good strategist. And he has put together, right across this year, this diplomatic thing which he's going to try to sell, which is that you and I are all going to get together and we're all going to whack ISIS because actually the bad guy isn't Assad. And then when the Americans start talking about a no-fly zone, all they're doing is talking hot air. He actually sends 14 fighter jets, 9 tanks, 20 so APCs, 200 or 300 at least combat troops. He's way ahead of the game. And what this is what they're going to be talking about. Obama, you better make sure your planes don't bump into our planes. What are we going to do about all this? And he will get something out of it because they will try to deliver a new peace deal. He's already got Kerry to say, well, perhaps Assad doesn't have to stand down right now. He's already got Merkel to say, well, perhaps Assad doesn't have to stand down right now. He's way ahead of the game. But the game is not so much Syria. It is, right, and as we're going to cooperate with you now, about these sanctions in Ukraine, when are they going to stop? I think the guy's playing a blinder, and I keep saying that in this studio, and I keep hearing that he's a loser. I haven't seen him do anything except win 9 out of 10.
Michael, do you agree with that analysis?
Say no.
No, just to have the discussion. Look, I think that it's all linked and it's all not linked. The world today is just such a mess, and you can see that no one can really fight with him. Putin is very smart. He knows that you can only press so far, and doesn't matter how much people scream, you know, in The Economist or in the pages of the Times, about his incursion into Ukraine. And it doesn't matter. And people should understand that in Washington, there are many people in think tanks who are children of or themselves exiled from the Baltics and Poland during the bad days of the Cold War. And they have an instinctive revulsion at the thought of a return of Russian power. I mean, initially they say, oh, he's a Soviet. He's not a Soviet. He's a Russian nationalist. And, you know, if you know anything of the history of that area, you know that Russian nationalism partitioned Poland back in the 18th century. And this is what people live in more.
But is it a Russian nationalist who wants a sphere of influence and wants
the near abroad
wants an empire?
But in that respect, you know, you can, you know, I mean, 100 years from now when we're all getting something beyond digital in our ears and we're dead, you know, people will look back and say, oh, there was that 25-year period after the Soviet Union when Russia wasn't its usual self. But on trend line, Russia is exactly where it was in the 19th century.
When the tide goes out, it comes back in, and it's coming back in.
And he is, and I have to say, at this moment, I think he is doing well in the sense that he knows that Obama cannot go to war. He's got two, and this is very important. People listening have to understand this. Obama can't go to war, even if he wants to, because his Congress will never get behind him. And you cannot go back into combat after the two unsuccessful missions in Afghanistan and Iraq unless you're going to have success, and you can't have success unless the Republicans back you. Putin understands that completely. In the long run, he has to watch out because the Russians have had no success at all themselves in going to war in Muslim countries. They had huge problems in Afghanistan. They were thrown out by the Mujahideen. They only subdued Chechnya inside Russia's borders by leveling it into nothingness.
The kit they're putting in, though, is standoff kit. It can keep the enemy at I don't think they might not go on the offensive apart from in the air. I don't think they're going to go on the offensive.
Well, they can work together on areas. I mean, when I was just in northern Iraq, Kurdistan last week, and came across some battlefield mobile phone video showing the aftermath of a U.S. airstrike on ISIS positions just south of Mosul. And that's verified for me, and I trust the source. So if they can work some kind of coordinated thing in the air, that's all to the better for dealing with the throat cutters. But the most important thing, of course, is what you do with a country that no longer exists, which is Syria.
On the issue of, you know, how far Putin can push things, knowing that the West won't do anything about it. I was in Ukraine earlier this week with NATO, and you had the Ukrainian president and prime minister saying, we need more defensive weapons. They're trying to say that, look, we are the front line in the sort of the Euro-Atlantic fight against Russia, and we need your support. And then you had the NATO Secretary General stood next to him saying, well, look, we understand that's what you want and we'll see what we can do, but we're not in the business of giving weapons. And Putin knows that, you know, he can push much further than the West is going to push back.
Which is why at some point he will push a little bit on the Baltics. That's a different kettle of fish because they're in NATO, Article 7, we have to come to their rescue. So I think he's going to push in the Baltics. He's going to prod. But that's a different thing because they are already inside NATO. But what he knows is we're saying to Georgia, we're saying to Moldova, and we're saying to Ukraine, sorry, guys, club's closed. You can't come in.
Mm. Let's move on slightly to the refugee crisis in Europe. And Angela Merkel has now said that actually the US and Russia need to be involved in finding a solution. Putin has called it the failure of Western Europe's foreign policy. Tim Marshall, first of all, how much support is Europe likely to get from America?
Not a great deal. Obama will lead from behind, as is his instinct when it comes to things a long way from America, looking east. The Americans are going to take 10,000 refugees. The Americans put in more money than anybody else. And I think that's about the limit of it. What Mrs. Merkel was referring to, sorry, what Putin was referring to about it needs the American, Merkel was referring to that needs the American and the Russians, is actually the peace deal for Syria. And that goes back to what I was saying about Putin. The Kremlin was a blur of activity right across the summer when the Americans and Brits and French were doing very little. Person after person, whether it was Netanyahu, Erdogan, Saudis, they were in and out. It's like a revolving door as they put together this idea that Assad can hang on for a couple of years, we'll bring in a general to be a new defense, we'll get some peace deal, and he's going to push this. I'm not sure it's going to work, but that's what he's been doing. And as I said, if the Americans buy into it, and the Russians and the Germans and the French and the British, if they all, and the Gulf states, if they all buy into it, it has a chance if they pressure people on the ground. But who's put the deal together? Putin.
Yeah. But to come back to the question about the migrants, look, Merkel is only saying the obvious. And the flaw is primarily in that the European Union exists. It's there. It's a force and a factor, and more of a force in trade than it is in other things, but it exists. And it's a factor in that sovereign nations within the EU can hide behind it and avoid their responsibilities. They have no foreign policy. We've been there. I mean, both Tim and I, you know, if you go back and look at what happened in Bosnia, Britain, Germany kicked the whole Balkan collapse off because of early recognition of Slovenia and then Croatia, and the whole thing fell apart without agreement. Then as violence took over, France and Britain went this way and that way, and nobody could take over. And then finally, it wasn't until the Americans came in and bombed this. You know what? This is how we'll do it. We're going to bomb them off the heights over Sarajevo. And they did it under NATO cover, but it was really the Americans. And suddenly, this has established how Europe conducts itself in terms of foreign policy. They created this position of foreign policy supremo. You know, it was Cathy Ashton, a British woman, and now it's an Italian woman whose name I can't even remember.
Federica Mogherini.
Federica Mogherini, who I've seen interviewed. She's a very intelligent woman. She has absolutely no power. And so in the end, Merkel is right. I mean, it will require the U.S. becoming involved. But how? Because what you have is you've got 150,000 people right now. It's like an army marching up through the Balkans. Some of them are trapped in Austria. I actually know some people who are trapped in Austria. They've come from Iraq. Getting into Germany. And here we are. It's an absolute crisis. And the fact that the leaders of the 28 nations of the European Union, with this incredible crisis, and it doesn't even involve shooting. You don't have to, you know, go into battle. Yeah. All you have to do is say, okay, look, we can commit this money. We can organize or try to organize immediately centers at Lesbos or whatever the port of entry is, and at least get some ID going on, some temporary ID, and start to rehouse people. We can try and bring Turkey on board to say, look, they're coming from your refugee camps. Can you do something to help? And it would require nothing more than staying up all night and not going out
but
for
there
dinner.
But there are essentially two issues here. One is, you know, Tim, as you were saying about mainly Syria, what happens with Syria and a political solution there. And that is clearly something that the European Union and its 28 member states is never really going to have a major influence over. And that is something that clearly is going to be a US and Russia coming together, perhaps with someone else, who knows. But on the issue of dealing with the refugee crisis right now, the actual here and now, is there something there where, when you look at what happened after Vietnam, you look at, also what happened after, people, 200,000 people fled Hungary in 1956. Mm. The Americans took lots of people there.
Exactly. And they took the Vietnamese. And this goes back to what Michael was saying about Bosnia. They dilly-dallied around the Europeans. Well, this is our crisis, middle of Europe, we're going to deal with this. They completely failed to deal with it. In then came the Americans in 1995 under Clinton and sorted it. They nailed down Dayton. It's fragile, but they nailed it down. And what are we doing now, the 28 countries, about this refugee crisis? Squabbling, threatening each other, unpleasant language. I think it's the Slovaks are threatening to go to court to say, we're not taking a quota. They just cannot seem to get their act together. Merkel, I think, was wrong to say our door is open to 800,000. That was a massive magnet, which is still attracting people because they haven't woken up yet that actually Europe doesn't really want to help that many people. It wants to help, but there are limits, it's saying, privately. So what does it take? It takes, as you say, Michael, staying up all night. Okay, how many tents have we got? How many staff have we got? Can we use the militaries? Let's get down to Greece. Let's get massive camps up. Let's register people. Let's do this properly. Instead, what you've got are this ragtag, terrible, terrible scenes of these tens of thousands of people walking up through Europe. Europe is not very impressive at times like this.
And Michael, is it time then that Europe actually needs its own refugee agency? Perhaps it needs a refugee agency more than foreign agency.
Well, the UN has always been part of that. I mean, in Bosnia, the UN had organized because there was so much, it was like Syria. I mean, everybody was displaced by the ethnic cleansing. There are agencies and there are NGOs. I mean, the main thing is that at a political level, you have to have a meeting in Brussels and order the commission to say, this is what we're going to do. And look, people know who the agencies are that are effective and which aren't. We're going to hire them. That's what bureaucrats should be doing, and get it sorted. And it wouldn't take long. Syria may never be settled. I mean, I honestly think there is no more Syria.
No,
and we'd all be much better to start talking about something else.
Yeah.
But, if you wait for a settlement on Syria, it will never happen. So you need to deal with the fact there's 4 million people outside of Syria who were living there 4 years ago, and you need to deal with that directly.
If we were to leave the Syria problem to one side, in a sense, because that's obviously impossible for us to solve in the minute and a half we've got left. Tim, is actually the 28 member states, European Union, part of the problem here? And that if actually Germany were to say, we need to deal with this, so therefore we will bilaterally with Greece help you deal with it ourselves. And if you need money, we'll pay for it. If you need staff, we'll help you.
Germany is capable. It has the technology, the brain power, and the money to say, right, we're going to do X, Y, and Z and do it unilaterally. And also, everybody else would say, oh, well, if you want us quietly to give you 100 million each, we'll do that because that's the easy way out. But the problem with that is Germany doesn't want a single nation state solution to an EU problem, because if you do that, what are you saying about the EU? You're actually chipping away at its very foundations. Now, look, they're being undermined with a jackhammer. But if you openly admit we're the only ones that can do anything, it doesn't say much about the European Union.
But does it perhaps actually, Michael, say a lot about the European Union if it's grown up enough to say, you know what, we can't all do this together, but we on our own, we can help out on this?
No, it says that the European Union, in times of crisis, its flaws are always demonstrated to the world, whether it's Greece or whether it's this. And it's really depressing to people like me who think, be real. Europe is such a small place. It should be united in some federal arrangement. But proof, it can't be.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Goldfarb and Tim Marshall, thank you both very much. We didn't get on to half of what we're going to talk about, but never mind, we'll try again tomorrow. That's that for Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federica Romaniello. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Chris Lord will be here from Istanbul next. Then it's Andrew Tuck at 1900. Midori House back at the same time again tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.